This address was delivered on October 17, 1989, at the 6th Annual Trinity Pastors Conference held at the Trinity Baptist Church in Montville, New Jersey.
One interpreter of Romans 13, 1 through 7, opened his article on those verses with these words. It always seems to be marching in fresh from the Middle Ages. No biblical passage continues to provoke quite as much controversy in Christian political thought as these verses from the 13th chapter of Paul's letter to the church at Rome. The text is countercultural vis-a-vis liberal democracies. And I hope that if you've reflected it at all upon what we were saying yesterday, that you feel something of the weight and validity of that particular commentator's comments, interpretation, introduction to Romans 13, 1 through 7. Yesterday we dealt with the occasion of Romans 13, 1 through 7, which was, as we proved through three complementary lines of evidence, Jewish, revolutionary, nationalism. And then we dealt with the definition of the call to subordination contained in Romans 13, 1. And we saw that it was a prohibition, as we should expect in that context, with that occasion for these verses. It was a prohibition of rebellion. It was a call to place oneself under the authority of the governing authorities, those powers which existed at that time. And then we dealt with the foundation of this call to subordination in Romans 13:1, and dealt with the words, "For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God." The first thing we dealt with there was the nature of that ordination of the civil authorities, and we saw that it is a matter not of God's decretive will, as the Anabaptist tradition argues, but that it is a matter of God's preceptive will, that the governing authorities are not simply overruled for the good of men, they are appointed by a preceptive act of God's will to authority over men. We saw that this means that they bear the sword legitimately, that they take vengeance legitimately, they have a vocation to do certain things that it is absolutely forbidden to private Christians to do. Then we saw the backdrop of their ordination, and we argued that this unusual conception, which combines in one sense the preceptive will of God with the universal providence of God, we saw that that leads us to a backdrop to this ordination that is directly related to the problem of revolutionary Jewish nationalism. And we saw that the New Testament regarded the politics of the Jewish zealots and their rejection of Roman authority as in the same category as Zedekiah's resistance to Nebuchadnezzar. We saw that God had judicially terminated the Old Testament theocracy. He had used the sword of Nebuchadnezzar to do so, and that Daniel's prophecies have revealed that not just one Gentile civil authority, but four, and the number is both literal and in some sense figurative, four such empires will bear rule over the people of God until that day in which Christ returns to re-erect the theocratic kingdom in its political and civil aspects. And of course, I hope you understand me not to be buying into certain dispensational theories of eschatology by using that terminology. I don't buy into those theories, but there is a genuine sense in which the Bible speaks of the kingdom in its future aspects as a re-erection of the theocratic kingdom. But now, we saw then finally the extent of their ordination, and I'm simply going to read those two paragraphs on page 15, which were the last two in the notes that were handed out that we got to yesterday. Oh, page 15, Pastor Martin, I believe. The extent of their ordination? Oh, I'm sorry, page 10. I have different notes than you do in terms of the page numbers. Thank you, sir. I stand corrected. I said at the conclusion of yesterday's studies that if we are right about the backdrop of Paul's assertions in verse 1, then this backdrop demands that the most absolute and universal meaning be given to the statements that there is no authority except from God and those which exist are established by God. This backdrop should clarify just how inhospitable the biblical terrain is to theories of just rebellion. For it is precisely to the autocratic Gentile kingdoms, as epitomized in Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, Artaxerxes' Persia, Alexander's Macedonia, and Nero's Rome, that God transfers civil authority over his people. And then we went on to say that even if this proposed backdrop to Paul's statements is disregarded, the language in itself permits no exceptions. It is not only completely general, but absolutely universal. Further, the powers that be, those which exist, to which Paul referred, in these assertions must be at least a reference to imperial Rome. Theories of just revolution, we concluded, seem conveniently to forget that the last three emperors at the period when Paul wrote this epistle had been in order Caligula, Claudius, and at the time Paul was writing, Nero. Now all of that, I hope, shows you why the commentator said that this passage always seems to be marching in fresh from the Middle Ages. Now, that brings us this morning to Roman numeral 4, the qualification of this call to subordination, or its qualification. Now, interpreters very commonly are eager to tell us that there are all sorts of exceptions to the, quote, general rules of Romans 13. Further, the position advocated here is so alien to our culture and the politics we were taught in our schools growing up that it may easily be misunderstood. And it is therefore necessary to address under this heading several qualifications that have been or are proposed for the call to subordination, and some of them legitimate and some of them illegitimate. And first of all, then, A here is the qualification, or is this statement. I want to say that conscientious disobedience to civil authority forms no exception to the imperative of Romans 13:1. Now, it should, of course, go without saying that Paul agreed with Peter when in the early chapters of Acts he endorsed the duty of conscientious disobedience to civil, and in fact any, human authority which compels us to violate the law of God. There can be no question that in any case where we are genuinely compelled to choose between the law of God and the commands of men, we must obey God rather than men. And it never ceases to amaze me, brethren, and indeed it raises profound suspicions within me when I hear or read evangelicals speak as if they have made some profound discovery when they speak of the duty of conscientious disobedience. That is such a patent truth of the Word of God that I always wonder what it really is they think they have discovered. The real question is this. Is the conscientious disobedience mandated by the Scriptures an exception to the requirement of subordination found in Romans 13:1? Or to put the question more clearly, is such conscientious disobedience, which is certainly patently biblical, is such conscientious disobedience insubordination? Is it rebellion? Is it incipient revolution? Is it forbidden by Romans 13:1's call to subordination? And the answer is clearly negative. Conscientious disobedience to certain of the demands of ordained human authorities is clearly consistent with the strictest subordination to their authority itself or in general. Lenski sees the matter very clearly when he asserts refusal to obey was not in any way standing against the arrangement of God. His way of talking about anti-tasso, being anti-tasso, the authorities being against them, the word used in verse 2. It was not in any way standing against the arrangement of God and the governmental authority this high court possessed. An analogy will helpfully illustrate Lenski's thought. A Christian wife, brethren, is not being rebellious or insubordinate when she refuses to obey the demand of her husband that she join in the local neighborhood wife-swapping party. To accuse such a wife of rebellion would be the grossest injustice. There is no assault upon or infringement of a superior's authority when a Christian refuses to obey a command to sin. Thus, Daniel, when he refused to cease praying at the command of Darius, can appeal to Darius after his deliverance from the lion's den and say, as the phrase should be translated in Daniel 6:22, "In your eyes I have committed no injury." In other words, Daniel appeals to Darius himself to confirm that Darius knew. Darius' own conscience informed him. Darius knew that there had been, by Daniel's conscientious disobedience, no assault upon Darius' authority, no rebellion, no incipient revolution. Now, all of this, of course, may to some appear to be fighting about words. But, brethren, it is not logomachy or fighting about words. Those familiar with the literature on this subject will attest that the exception of just rebellion is often sneaked in the door with the assumed exception of conscientious disobedience. People think if there can be one exception, why not more? Conscientious disobedience cannot be used to prove the necessity of making exceptions to Romans 13:1. Because it is not, in any proper sense, an exception at all. Well, that's the first statement under qualifications. The second is this. Both the implicit and explicit teaching of the rest of the scriptures prohibits revolution. Now, we've already noted the language of Romans 13:1 and how it is absolutely universal. And we've already noted as well the fact that God precisely and exactly transferred civil authority over the people of God to such Gentile empires as those headed by Nebuchadnezzar, Cyrus, and Alexander, not to mention Nero and Caligula. And all of that creates a vast presumption in favor of the idea that the Bible permits no exceptions to its prohibition of revolution. But we must go on to say that the fact is that there are the whole drift of biblical admonition, the whole drift of biblical admonition on this subject contradicts any theory of just revolution. You may go through the text we quoted yesterday in the New Testament and a multitude of texts in the Old Testament. I'm not going to turn to any of them. And the whole drift of biblical admonition on this subject is that Christians and citizens and subjects are to be subject to their civil authority. They are to pray for them. They are to obey them. They are to be in subjection to them. And there is never any suggestion that it should be otherwise. Now, time cannot be taken here to thoroughly exegete them, but of special interest are a number of biblical statements which emphatically prohibit revolution. Proverbs 24, verses 21 and 22, clearly advises against revolutionary activity when it says, "My son, fear the Lord and the king. do not associate with those who are given to change. And though it's paraphrastic in its translation, the NIV properly understands this phrase and translates, do not associate with the rebellious. For their calamity will rise suddenly, and who knows the ruin that comes from both of them? Peter was opposing the greatest injustice ever perpetrated by civil authority when Jesus rebuked him with these words, put your sword back into its place, for all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Matthew 26:52. Jesus clearly disclaims revolutionary violence to establish his kingdom when he asserts, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting that I might not be delivered up to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. John 18:36. In the very act of unjustly perpetrating the greatest miscarriage of justice in the history of world government, Pilate was addressed by Jesus in these words. Jesus acknowledged the authority of Pilate with these words. He said, you would have no authority over me unless it had been given you from above. John 19:11. You see, in the very act of performing the greatest miscarriage of justice by a civil government in the history of the world, Jesus, in that very act, acknowledged the authority of Pilate. The word used is exousia, legal right. Now, this statement implies that governments do not forfeit their general status or authority simply because they engage in gross acts of injustice. And this implication must be explored under the next heading. And this brings us to C then, which is this. The scriptures do not condition attaining or maintaining legitimate civil authority or our duty to subordinate ourselves to our civil authorities on the behavior of the government. Now, I think I need to state that a little bit more clearly. The scriptures do not condition our duty to submit to civil authority on the nature of the origin of that civil authority, on the nature of its form, on the nature of its character. That's what I'm saying. Obviously, the Bible prohibits revolutionary activity and originating a civil government through revolutionary activity. But once that government is an authority that is a power that, as Romans 13:1 says, one of the powers that be, once it is that, the question of its origin, I say the question of its form, and I say also the question of its character is irrelevant to our duty to submit to it. Now, it is often maintained, sometimes vaguely, and sometimes plainly, that governments may forfeit their authority if they do not conform to some standard of conduct. And that minimal standard of conduct is variously stated. But in one recent publication, John Whitehead, Francis Schaeffer, P.R. Gilchrist, and Samuel Rutherford are quoted to this end, and the writer concludes, those rulers who reject moral law entirely, that's his minimal standard, will find that mantle, the mantle of authority he means, is lifted. Christian cooperation will be replaced by confrontation, and respect will be superseded by resistance. Now, let me just say that one of my pet peeves in this whole discussion is that everybody uses the term resistance and nobody defines it. You don't know what in the world someone means when they say resistance, and so I usually avoid using it. Anyway, this Christianized version of the social contract theory, which was taught by Samuel Rutherford and was taught by Francis Schaeffer, this Christianized version of the social contract theory of government is no doubt the American way. What do I mean by the Christianized version of the social contract theory of government? It is the social contract theory, that of Locke and some of the earlier political philosophers, Rousseau and others, was that government only has authority because there's this assumed contract in which the people have given government its authority. And the Christian version of that is that the God gives the people the authority and they mediate it to the government. That's the Christianized version of the social contract theory of government. It's what Samuel Rutherford teaches, it's what Francis Schaeffer teaches, and many others in the Reformed tradition. Now, what I want to say is that this Christianized version of the social contract theory of government is no doubt the American way. And it certainly may claim the authority of the Declaration of Independence. And it certainly has been the theory embraced by many in the Reformed tradition. The only problem with it is the Bible. Incredibly, however, this theory is frequently imported into Romans 13 itself, by way of verses 3 and 4. Charles Hodge, in typical fashion, argues, the design of civil government is not to promote the advantage of rulers, but of the ruled. They are ordained and invested with authority to be a terror to evildoers and a praise to them that do well. On this ground our obligation rests. And the obligation ceases when this design, now here's Hodge's way of stating the minimal standard, is systematically, constantly, and notoriously disregarded. Where unfaithfulness on the part of the government exists, or where the form of it is incompatible with the design of its institution, the governed must have a right to remedy the evil, but they cannot have the moral right to remedy one evil by the production of a greater. Now here Hodge begins to show some commendable caution with his theory of revolution. And therefore, as there are few greater evils than instability and uncertainty in governments, the cases in which revolutions are justifiable must be exceedingly rare, verses 3 through 7. Now Hodge's statement may be taken as representative of many others who attempt to read out of verses 3 and 4 support for the theory under discussion. And we may helpfully critique these interpreters by several comments upon Hodge's statement. First of all, Hodge is correct to assert that the design of civil authority is the advantage of the ruled, at least in part. Hodge is incorrect when he deduces from this the right of revolution by the governed. Only if the social contract theory of government is assumed can this deduction be justified. It does not follow logically from the premise unless one assumes that in the first place that the people mediate to the government its power. And this the passage does not teach. It rather teaches the opposite, that authority comes from God. There is no mention of the idea that it comes from God through the people. Neither does this conclusion follow analogically. Does a wife have a right to renounce her husband because he refuses to rule her for her advantage? Does a child have a right to renounce the authority of its parents because they do not govern the child to his advantage? Both analogies, brethren, are preposterous. To say the very least, then, one cannot regard Hodge's logic as conclusive. Two, Hodge also manifests a commendable caution when he states that the occasions upon which revolutions are prudent are exceedingly rare. It needs to be asked, however, how the potential revolutionary is to be sure that his revolution will not do more harm than good. By what gift of prophecy or omniscience can the potential revolutionary be sure, first, that his revolution will succeed, and second, that it will achieve the greater good? Unless he can be sure of this, however, Hodge says that he has no moral right to revolt. How, then, could such a potential revolutionary ever have a good conscience about revolution? Hodge's commendable caution, therefore, really annuls his theory. Thirdly, Hodge says the obligation ceases, the obligation to obey or submit to government, The obligation ceases when this design is systematically, constantly, and notoriously disregarded. Or in the words of Ostrander, I quoted early, when it ignores the moral law entirely. Now, this is Hodge's attempt to deal with the dilemma of setting a minimum standard for government, which, if violated, provides the right of revolution. It illustrates clearly the difficulty of finding an objective standard for the theory of just revolution. This standard, as stated by Hodge, may sound objective, may sound good, but in fact it is very subjective. Would you like to be in the position of counseling a Christian woman with an unconverted husband and telling her that she may divorce her husband when he systematically, constantly, and notoriously disregards the design of his authority over her? That would be great help, wouldn't it? What's systematic? What's constant? What is notorious disregard of the design of civil authority? And in fact, we may raise the question, has any government ever? Because apparently Caligula's didn't, and Nero's didn't, and Nebuchadnezzar's didn't. Has any government ever disregarded the moral law entirely and constantly? Fourthly, Hodge adds, where unfaithfulness on the part of the government exists, or where the form of it is incompatible with the design of its institution, the governed must have a right to remedy the evil. And thus Hodge connects the legitimacy of government with its form and character. Now, brethren, the Bible certainly requires all civil authorities to themselves obey God. There's no question about that. There are some difficulties with it, but there are no questions about it. There can be none in any kind of Calvinistic or Reformed system. There is no scriptural evidence, however, that Christians are permitted to suspend their subordination to civil authority when it reaches a given degree of depravity, or if in its form it does not conform to our ideas of democracy and limited government. The actual powers to whom Paul was referring in Romans 13, as we have observed, were not paragons of theocratic virtue. If Caligula, Claudius, and Nero did not violate the standard, who does? Nebuchadnezzar, Darius, Artaxerxes, and other ancient pagan autocrats were, to say it plainly, bloody tyrants according to our Bibles. And yet Daniel, Jeremiah, Mordecai, Esther, Ezra, Nehemiah, and many other Old Testament saints not only submitted to them, but actually served in influential positions in their governments. Further, these governments were not in their origin and form such as Hodge suggests. They were in their natures, to use the imagery of Daniel 7 and 8, bestial. Bestial in their origin, form, and character. None of this, however, is utilized by the Apostle Paul or the other writers of the Bible to justify a biblical version of the social contract theory, or to maintain that so depraved had these governments become that they had forfeited their right to subordination. I read recently, and I believe the source is accurate, when it asserted that 14 of the first 15 Roman emperors were open homosexuals. Now that tells you something about the character and the absoluteness of Paul's attitudes on this subject. Fifthly, Hodge also observes they are ordained and invested with authority to be a terror to evildoers and a praise to them that do well. On this ground, our obligation rests. Now, I assume that Hodge is deducing this statement from the fact that both verses 3 and 4 begin with the explanatory conjunction for. Now, let's read them. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For It is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil. Now, Hodge apparently regards this conjunction, for, as introducing the ground of Christian obligation to civil authority. But there are several problems with this. First, Paul has already introduced the theoretical ground for subordination to civil authority in verse 1b. For, he says, there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Now, even if we regard verses 3 and 4 as stating a further ground of this authority and of our obligation, it is illicit for Hodge to reason as if verses 3 and 4 contain the only ground of our obligation to subordinate ourselves to civil authority. Second, it is much more likely, and even I may say certain, that what we have in verses 3 and 4 is not the ground of our obligation to civil authority, but an encouragement to perform that obligation. It is, says Paul, in our self-interest to submit to civil authority. The ground of our obligation and an encouragement to perform it are, however, patently two different things. Let me illustrate. If I tell my four sons to hurry and clean up their rooms by 5 o'clock and I'll take them out to McDonald's to eat, that is an encouragement to perform their obligation, but it is certainly not the ground upon which their obligation rests, or upon the ground upon which their obligation for them to clean up the room diligently rests. And so, secondly, we say it's more likely that we have an encouragement and not the ground of our obligation here. And third, it is certainly not likely that Paul would provide an encouragement to the Roman Christians, with all the pressure upon them to ignore what he's saying and to create exceptions to it, it is certainly not likely that Paul would provide an encouragement to the Roman Christians to perform their duty, which by implication undermines it. If Paul is even by implication in verses 3 through 5 conditioning subordination to the Roman government upon its origin, which was that of conquest, its form, which was that of autocracy, or its character, which was depraved, if Paul is even by implication in verses 3 through 5 conditioning subordination to the Roman government upon its origin, form, or character, as the theory under discussion suggests, he would be providing every potential revolutionary in the Roman churches with more than adequate reasons to ignore everything he said in verses 1 and 2. Fourth, the theory under discussion regards verses 3 and 4 as normative. That's the language that's often used to describe this theory. As normative, as stating norms for civil government. They read it that government ought to reward the good, praise the good, and punish the evil. And so they read, for rulers ought to be a cause of fear for good behavior, or ought not to be a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do what is good, and you ought to have praise from the same. If you do what is evil, you ought to be afraid if the civil government does its job, for it does not bear the sword of God in vain. For it ought to be a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil. You see, this normative view of verses 3 and 4 turns Paul's is into an ought to be. It makes Paul say, for it ought to be a minister of God to you for good. But brethren, this is patently not what Paul says. Furthermore, this interpretation completely unhinges Paul's argument. These verses are intended as encouragement. But what kind of encouragement is it to say, do what is good because your civil authorities ought to reward you? Surely this invites the retort, they ought to, but who knows if they will? Especially since the one we're talking about is Nero. It would be no encouragement to my sons if I told my four sons, work hard and clean up your rooms by 5 o'clock and I ought to take you to McDonald's for supper. And it wouldn't work very well either, let me tell you. The normative view is clearly wrong, but it does point out a perceived problem with the proper understanding of the passage. And that proper understanding of verses 3 and 4 is often called the descriptive view. Paul is clearly telling us what civil authorities, even pagan Roman civil authorities, actually do, and not merely what they are intended to do. Cranfield states the problem this raises. Verses 3 and 4 are puzzling. The difficulty is, of course, that Paul seems to take no account of the possibility of the governments being unjust and punishing the good work and praising the evil. And, brethren, that's a very real problem exegetically, and it ought to be addressed. I'm going to try to do that. Now, the key to this problem and to unlocking its solution is provided by giving attention to the Old Testament foundations of Paul's thought on this subject, and particularly to the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. Paul has quoted from this literature in the immediately preceding context. In Romans 12:20, he quotes Proverbs 25:21 and following. There are significant structural and conceptual parallels between verses 3 and 4 and the Proverbs. It must be observed that one can raise precisely the same difficulty with many of the political statements of the Proverbs as Cranfield raises with Romans 13, 3 and 4. Proverbs 14:35 asserts, "The king's favor is toward a servant who acts wisely, but his anger is toward him who acts shamefully." Proverbs 16:13 is similar. "Righteous lips are the delight of kings, and he who speaks right is loved." We might ask of such statements, are righteous lips always the delight of every king, even every theocratic king? Is the king's favor always toward a servant and who acts wisely? Well, how will the difficulty epitomized in such questions be solved? Well, I think in this way. The supremacy of the ethical interest and emphasis of Proverbs must be recognized. In other words, such proverbs are not primarily intended to make assertions about the nature of civil rulers, but to encourage wise behavior and righteous speaking in the presence of kings. The promissory aspects of these proverbs are introduced as motivations and encouragement to the supreme thing, which is such wisdom as righteous lips and acting wisely. Such promises are not intended as absolute, but rather as general promises. They are encouragements based on the general tendencies exhibited in God's providential government of the world. Normally, righteous lips are such as please kings. Normally, in God's providential government of the world, the king's favor is toward a servant who acts wisely. Even if the king is such as Ahab, his favor may be towards one who fears the Lord greatly, such as Obadiah, who hid those servants in the cave, you remember. The non-absolute character of such encouragements or general promises may be illustrated widely in the Proverbs. Proverbs 10, 3, and 4, and 7. Proverbs 12, 11, and 24 contain promises to the diligent, to the righteous. The hand of the diligent shall bear rule, you remember. The promises of Proverbs to the diligent, the righteous, or the godly parent may be falsified again and again, unless it is understood that they state the general tendencies of certain behavior in God's world and that they are not intended as absolute promises. The crucial point in all of this for our present purposes is, however, this. It is patently and evidently wrong to view these promises as conditions or prerequisites of the behavior they encourage. How would it be, for instance, if a Christian who lived in a communist society argued this way? In a communist society, it is impossible for me to become rich even if I am diligent. Therefore, it is not my duty to be diligent. But that's patently repugnant argumentation. Morally and biblically repugnant. Even so, it is morally repugnant to argue, my authorities do not reward the good and punish the evil, therefore I do not have a duty to subordinate myself to them. Ritterboss perceptively notes, Paul's position is not founded in the first instance on what is to be expected from the civil authorities, but what one owes them for God's sake. To derive such argumentation from Romans 13, 3 and 4 is perverse, and a perversion of both the intentions and implications of those verses. All right, now a fourth thing to say under this whole matter of qualifications, having dealt with the potential objections raised from Romans 13, 3 and 4. So D, the biblical examples often cited in favor of the theory of just revolution are inapplicable. Now, I do not suppose that I can here anticipate every biblical example which might be brought forward against my thesis. There are two, however, from the period of the theocratic kingdom, which are often mentioned and which superficially appear to be quite weighty. They are the examples of Jeroboam's rebellion against Rehoboam, 1 Kings 12:20, and Ehud's assassination of Eglon, king of Moab, and successful overthrow of their hegemony over Israel. Now, these two examples respectively illustrate two key factors which undercut their usefulness to the advocates of just revolution. First, during the period under discussion, direct revelation was a reality. The presence of such revelation meant that God might directly impart the right of monarchy to a man like Jeroboam in a way that it is not possible, that is not possible today. Such revelation was very significant in the whole incident of Jeroboam's rise to power. Compare 1 Kings 12:24. Such direct revelation means that it is inappropriate to regard Jeroboam's assumption of civil authority as necessarily an act of revolution. If the prime theocratic king revealed that he should be king of the northern 10 tribes, then it certainly wasn't revolution. Many other factors might be discussed here, but it is the pivotal importance of direct revelation in this situation which I wish to stress. Second, closely related to this is the reality that during the period of the theocratic kingdom of Israel, as we saw yesterday, unique factors were operating. We have already pointed out that with the destruction of the theocratic kingdom by Nebuchadnezzar, under the judgment of God, a new redemptive historical situation arose in regard to the relation of the people of God to civil authority. We have further pointed out that this new situation may be consciously in Paul's mind when he issues the imperative of Romans 13:1 about that kingdom which was the fourth empire of Daniel's prophecies. It is illegitimate, therefore, to cite examples of supposed just revolution from the period of the theocratic kingdom. During the whole period from Sinai till Nebuchadnezzar, a divinely authorized civil government for the people of God was in existence. The special revelation in which that government was delineated was always the legal or legitimate government of the people of God during that period. It is a plain violation of these plain scriptural facts, therefore, to regard or cite Ehud's assassination of Eglon as an example of rebellion. It was rather a vigorous assertion of subordination to Ehud's true civil authority, the theocratic constitution of Israel, and his true king, Jehovah. Now, these identical observations also apply to the supposed revolt of Jehoiada against Athaliah, which is often also cited. E. Subordination implies the idea of a defined jurisdiction or sphere of authority. And here we come to a qualification which I think is legitimate. Subordination implies the idea of a defined jurisdiction or sphere of authority. The term hupotasso, as we saw yesterday, the idea of an authoritative order. In biblical thought, no such order is absolute and unlimited except that of God. He has ordained a number of such human authorities, each with its own defined and peculiar area of jurisdiction. The civil authority, like the parental and the ecclesiastical, is limited in its jurisdiction. Neither the parental nor the ecclesiastical authorities derive their authority from the civil. Their spheres of authority are sovereign, directly, that is to say, derived from God, not subordinate to or mediated from the civil authority. Now, this is, of course, implied in Luke 20, 25. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Some things, you see, do not come within the sphere of Caesar's jurisdiction. Luke 20, 25 is echoed in Romans 13, 6, and 7. Render to all what is due them. Hence, though the civil authority may never be violently assaulted, it may be disobeyed when it seeks to impose its power outside its sphere. And so may any other human authority. Now, of course, the civil authority may disobey the divine norms and bring civil penalties against those who do so disobey. The Christian may then be obliged to flee or suffer, but he may never resist or oppose the existing authorities. F. Romans 13, 1 through 7 does not address every difficulty which may be raised about the Christian's civil allegiance. Brethren, legitimate questions do sometimes exist as to whom the legitimate representatives of the civil authority really are, or even as to which government is really the existing authority. These and many other issues are not at stake in our passage and do not touch the question of revolution itself. Revolution is armed defiance of the existing authorities. Paul's prohibition of such revolution assumes that such authorities were, in his case, and are ordinarily clearly identifiable. The fact is, and this is what Paul obviously assumes, that in most cases, this assumption is not problematic. And if we so create a view of civil authority that it becomes problematic, then we've got problems. Well, concluding observations. Now, I'm keenly aware that the perspectives regarding civil authority, which I have defended this morning, are both alien and we might almost say un-American. In our political atmosphere, they are customarily ignored or misunderstood in the present ferment on social issues among evangelicals. I'm also keenly aware that some of you may not, at least immediately, be able to adopt a position which raises so many questions for you about cherished political ideals. I am convinced, however, that the massive biblical evidence I have presented demands a hearing from you. I am convinced that a fair-minded assessment of this evidence and of the modern evangelical debate must draw at least this conclusion, that most of the Christian debate on political issues in our day is terribly superficial in its attention to the teaching of the Bible. And I am therefore convinced that the teaching of the Bible to which I have attempted to draw your attention is pregnant with enormous implications for that debate. It's like a fat old hound dog about to deliver 13 puppies. But the time tells us that there's no time to watch and see all those puppies delivered. It must suffice to say that the teaching I have presented provides us with a set of biblical premises which are diametrically opposed to much of Christian Reconstructionism, to belligerent fundamentalism, to all of liberation theology, to the reactionary Christian conservatism advocating tax revolt, and to the radical wing of the anti-abortion movement. If the positions advocated today are true, and there is massive biblical evidence that they are true, the theoretical foundations of these movements, as they are now constructed, are wrecked. And I say that with no hesitation. Well, time is gone, and we'll take up biblical civil disobedience in the next hour.